You're listening to the Takeaway Podcast. You can also find us on Twitter at The Takeaway and on Facebook at facebook.com/The Takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening.
Just take those old records off the shelf.
Risky business. Didn't I tell you that on this program today? But no Tom Cruise jumping on the couch or anything. We're going to examine some new regulations to control risk in the financial industry. We'll also look at risks General Motors faces in a newly competitive environment and under new leadership. We'll have an exploration of the car culture in Iran and some car memories from you later this hour. Then, on a sobering note, we'll talk about nuclear risks from the turbulent leadership inside North Korea right now, and we'll have a deeper examination of the global risk of nuclear war. Our guest at the end of the hour says looking at individual countries does not give you the full picture of nuclear risks. But we begin with the idea of risk and money, the riskiest business of all. Should banks be allowed to make big gambles with money not on their own books, not part of their own profits? Former Federal Reserve Chair Paul Volcker says generally no. And he came up with a rule named after him to regulate risk in financial markets.
The philosophy of the rule, which of course is adopted in the law, is that institutions that are being supported, defended, encouraged by public policy should not be expending their energy and their risks on proprietary trading. By definition, trading they're doing for the benefit of their stockholders, perhaps, certainly for the benefit of their own bonuses, should not be supported by public policy.
Paul Volcker speaking last March. The Volcker rule became the centerpiece of the Dodd-Frank Act passed by Congress back in June of 2010, and it was officially approved by financial regulatory authorities yesterday. We're joined by Catherine Wild. She's president and CEO of the Partnership for New York City. She also sits on the New York Fed. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, John.
Let's make clear you're not speaking for the New York Fed or the Federal Reserve in any capacity here.
Correct.
But let's talk about the Volcker rule. Does it radically change things? And then I want to get into a slight bit of the technicalities about it. And then really there's a general sense of how this is going to affect the financial industry here in New York. What do you make of the rule?
Well, number one, the concept of the rule has been anticipated for the last 3.5 years since Dodd-Frank was passed, and it was clear there was going to be restrictions, new restrictions in this area on this kind of risk-taking. So our financial institutions have been preparing for it and beginning to figure out how to divest themselves of some of the activities, the hedge funds, the private equity, and the proprietary trading activities that have been underway. So I think there's relief that the rule is finally promulgated. It is 900 pages. So while Paul Volcker made a rather simple declaratory statement, figuring out exactly what it means and the bank and the enforcement by the regulators of the rule is going to be tough. Fortunately, they put in enough time that the conformance, full conformance for the rule doesn't happen until July of 2015. So there is time to kind of figure out what's going on. So I think most of the response from industry to date, while they're still studying the details of this 900-page rule, most are saying that it's something they can and will live with.
Now, part of this is you're forbidden to do this, that, and the other thing, and part of this is a set of incentives. How can you enforce a bank, you know, not giving bonuses to people who make big, giant risks, like the billion-dollar J.P. Morgan Chase problems that surfaced a few years ago?
Well, clearly it's the spirit of the law, and they're starting by making clear that the CEO is responsible for setting up a compliance system that's going to work. I was talking to one of our big banks lately that said in the last year they've hired 700 new people in their compliance area. So there's going to be a heavy emphasis on, I think, preemptive action by the institutions. Nobody's going to want to be stuck violating this rule, and so I think people are going to be very conscious of the spirit of the law and working to make sure they are in conformance.
I don't want to get technical here. I know you don't want to get technical, but if I'm wandering through a bank and, you know, looking at the various desks and offices, can I tell the difference between somebody who's making proprietary trades over here and somebody who's just investing in T-bills over here?
Well, obviously not, but hopefully the compliance and the training that's going on within the bank institutions is going to pretty much dictate behavior on the part of the traders. The idea that a bank examiner can figure that out is I think, kind of naive. So it's going to depend, I think, on the internal strengths of the institutions and their tooling up for that.
Isn't the brand of the New York financial industry all about, hey, we took some risks and we made tons of money for
high
all
flyers.
Of you folks? Yeah, exactly. And is that going to change?
Yes, but it's changing globally. And in fact, in Europe, the restrictions are even more onerous. So I think that after the financial crisis, it was clear that we had to pull back, that we could not expose taxpayers and our overall economy to what happened in 2008, and that there had to be a new reform regime. I think financial institutions are embracing that concept, and it would be great if we had a consistent global regulatory system. We don't, but I think the U.S. has taken a very responsible set of actions, and that our U.S. institutions are following suit.
Under the Volcker Rule, banks are limited into how much they can invest in hedge funds, which, of course, are fundamentally unregulated. What's that going to do to the hedge fund industry here in New York? And I'm wondering if all those hedge funds up in Connecticut, because this is really the Detroit of the financial industry, New York City is, if they're going to move back to New York, if that's going to migrate any financial institutions in or out of this city?
Well, presumably there will be, as banks spin off their hedge fund and private equity activity, there will be some more there'll be some new businesses created, smaller businesses with affiliations. We would very much like to keep them in New York City. It's no longer Greenwich to which they're fleeing, where they went because there was some tax advantage a few years ago over New York City. They were going to Greenwich, Connecticut. Now it's West Palm Beach, where Florida has no income tax and is very attractive when the all-in tax burden in New York City is up to 54% on marginal income tax rates. So,
changes afoot. So
our big concerns are more about we don't want to lose the hedge fund and private equity business. They're very important to the New York metropolitan area economy. We consider Greenwich, Connecticut a suburb.
We'll see what happens going forward. Catherine Wild, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Catherine Wild is president and CEO of the Partnership for New York City. This is The Takeaway. From the financial thing to the vision thing now, General Motors has left its life-threatening financial woes behind and faces an identity problem looking into the future.
In a sense, you have to guess where the market's going to be. And as I think Wayne Gretzky said, you can't skate to where the puck is. You have to skate to where you think it's going to be. And so when we come out with more dramatic designs in particular, or new engine types, or new forms of propulsion, we are taking risk.
It's Dan Akerson, the CEO of General Motors, speaking in May of last year on this program. But Akerson will not be taking the company into that new future filled with risk and hockey metaphors. Akerson is retiring, and the company has officially named its first woman CEO as his replacement, GM veteran Mary Barra, who has her own sports metaphors to describe the job before her in a strongly male corporate culture.
Putting a car, truck, or crossover on the road is a team sport, and I just view myself as part of the team. If by being a woman, I could encourage young women who like math and science to not shy away from it and to pursue technical careers, I love doing that. But, you know, at General Motors, you know, I think I've got the best job on the field there to be able to work on product all day long, but, you know, really it's a great team.
Mary Barra speaking there on Bloomberg News. Jacqueline Tropp joins us now, automotive reporter based in Detroit. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So, Jacqueline, does Mary Barra have the best job on the field or the hardest corporate job in the world, maybe second only to running Microsoft right about now?
I would definitely say she's got the hardest job in the world now. Not only are all eyes on her, but this is probably one of the most challenging times to take the helm at GM. It's finally at a place of stability, and it's profitable, and it's doing well, which just increases the pressure to keep that momentum going.
It's got stiff competition from Ford. Is there a Ford pathway for General Motors, or do they really have to strike out on their own to make a fundamentally different kind of identity and strategy?
I think they are already making a fundamentally different kind of identity for themselves, especially in their global markets and with the new products they have coming down the line. like smaller trucks and more electric vehicles. I think Dan Akerson definitely put the company on the path to prosperity. But the challenge now that everyone will be looking to will be to see if that momentum continues despite the leadership changeup.
What do you think of the investments in alternative fuels, in hydrogen, in electric cars? Do those investments stay on the books, get more aggressive, or does Barra attempt to manage a more conservative product line?
They really do have to get more aggressive because of the federal fuel economy standards and the deadline to meet the certain MPG requirements that are coming up over the next 9 or so years. So there's not really that much flexibility in terms of focusing on fuel efficiency. The task to pay attention to will be to see how that's done and whether that's done in a way that consumers are interested in and will pull their wallets out for.
Is Barra, you know, one of the sort of car culture types, very much associated with design and brand identity, conveying the sexiness and sort of status qualities of automobiles? Or is she more of a corporate, she sounds a little more like a corporate team member?
She has said before that manufacturing is a team sport, but I think one of the key reasons why she was chosen for the CEO role is because she has such far-ranging experience in every single corner of GM. I was speaking to the senior vice president of global human resources yesterday, and she said that everyone in GM headquarters really feels as though they know her just because she has worked in every single department.
And so the issue of being a woman leader in a very male-dominated culture, that's an obsolete notion, or does she still have a bit of a headwind to look forward to?
No, it's not obsolete. This is such a huge milestone that I cannot emphasize it enough. This is huge. For the last 100 years, it could be argued that the automotive industry has been a boys' club. And over the last 20 or 30 years, more women started to join the ranks. But this is a hugely symbolic move to show that the auto industry is no longer off limits to women. Women and men can achieve in top leadership roles across the board. And it's rather unfortunate, but I think there will be extra pressure and extra eyes on her just because she is the first woman.
Jacqueline Tropp is automotive reporter based in Detroit for the New York Times. Jacqueline, thanks so much.
Thank you.
El Dorado. You don't even need to hear the words General Motors to know that that's a Cadillac. I could have given you tunes about T-Birds, Chevys, Corvettes, GTOs, and each one evokes a distinct car culture and time. To Iranians, this is the top 40 car hit of all time, the boxy, chromeless, four-wheel, one-size-fits-all Iranian-made Paycan sedan. No longer manufactured, the Paycan retains its emotional connection to people who grew up with it. And this homely little car may just be a bridge between two divided nations that share a car culture, Iran and the U.S. 37-year-old Iranian design engineer Shaheen Armin worked in the U.S. auto industry for 13 years, spending time at Chrysler in Michigan, Honda in Ohio. Now in Tehran, he's at the center of a revitalized cult of the Paycan car. Paycan is art, transportation, and a source of cherished memories that Armin documents on his popular blog. From Tehran, Shaheen Armin, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you, John. It's my honor.
So I got to ask you right off the top, how many times have you had to push start a Paycan, Shaheen?
quite a few times, yeah, when I was in my teenage years, when I was growing up here in Tehran.
Now, what is it about the Paycan that produces so many emotional reactions, some of which you received in response to your blog and some of which you've actually seen as people, you know, reach out and touch the Paycan either of their youth or a car that's been resurrected in some way mechanically?
You know, Paycan has been here for 46 years. The production started in 1967. At least four generations of Iranians have been involved with this car, either driving in it or that was their first car or being in the taxis. And, you know, the car has been through more than four decades of Iran's history, you know. So there is so much nostalgia, especially the older models, you know, because it reminds people of the Shah time. It also, during the 80s, when we were with war with Saddam, you know, during the 1980, during the 80s, this car was a primary source of income for so many Iranians. You know, they would carry passengers as freelance taxi drivers, and it would make extra money. I mean, one Paycan was basically feeding and supplying the entire family. It's quite hard to believe, but that was really the case, you know.
Now, having spent a little time in Tehran and seeing just the sort of driving patterns of Iranians, can you give me a definitive answer on how many people you can actually fit into a Paycan?
Including the driver, six.
But so, I've seen it with 12. I mean, I've seen people piled on top of it. I mean,
yeah. I mean, the Paycan pickup, it's unbelievable how much you can load on that thing. I mean, it's a workhorse. I mean, they're everywhere around Iran, and they're, you know, carrying goods everywhere. So,
was the Shah right that Iran needed a national car back then? Because a lot of the nationalism of the Shah was really the qualities that the Islamic Revolution pushed back on and tried to eradicate completely.
You know, the Shah, through his policy, he was trying to modernize Iran, you know, and he was trying to do it at such a fast pace. And having a car industry is a symbol of progress, you know. So after the revolution, the car became very important too. A friend of mine actually said, you know, and the intersection of these two regimes is the Paycan.
Wow.
In some ways, it is true, because after the revolution, it changed its meaning from a symbol of consumerism and middle class. Paycans became all white. They were debadged and dechromed, and they didn't even have radios. So they were just simple white Paycans, and they became a symbol of resistance, a symbol of revolution, honestly, you know.
And now driving a red Paycan is also a symbol of resistance and provocation in Tehran. Maybe not so much, but you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, Iran has an amazing car culture. I mean, people probably don't realize that over in the U.S., but people are passionate about cars. And for this culture of Paycan lovers, there is nothing more Iranian than this car. I mean, back of their mind, they know that this was a British car and we didn't design or engineer it here, but for them, it is Iranian. I mean, in some sense, this car is more Iranian than British.
Can you tell me your two or three favorite modifications that you've seen that users and drivers have made of Paycons, either to the exterior, the interior, or even souping up the engine?
Yeah, I mean, they do a lot of stuff, but lowering in it is a very popular thing to do. I mean, they lower it all the way down, man. And, you know, adding lots of gizmos and little gadgets, and the gear shift knob with flowers and little decorations, that's very, very popular among them, you know.
I mean, in a way, the car culture of the Paycan just reminds me of, you know, 1960s L.A. or, you know, 1970s Detroit. I mean, the modifications of the gear shift you're describing. Maybe the Paycan is the key for Americans to understand that there's really a connection between the U.S. and Iran.
Absolutely. I always said that. I always said that through cars, we can connect in so many different amazing ways, you know. I actually imported a Paycan from England to the U.S. Actually, it's not a Paycan. It's the British version of it. But I would drive it around in Detroit, and people couldn't believe it. And people would talk to me. It's like, are you crazy? Why didn't you import a Triumph or something like that? And I would just say, you know, come on, guys, you don't understand what this car means to me. I mean, it doesn't go fast. It's not racy in any sense. But there's just so much. I mean, every corner of this car has memories for me.
Well, before we go, what's your best guess? You think President Rouhani or even the Supreme Leader has had an experience push-starting a Paycan?
I have a picture of a Supreme Leader in a Paycan, but who knows? Yeah, probably. I mean, back then in the 80s and 70s, there were, like, you know, pretty much all the passenger cars in Iran were Paycans. So I wouldn't be surprised. No.
Well, that's a unifying force right there politically.
Absolutely.
Shaheen Armon, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, John.
Shaheen Armon has worked in the auto industry for 13 years, including time at Chrysler in Michigan, Honda in Ohio. He returned to Tehran, where he runs a blog about the Paycon. You can see a picture of the Paycon on our site, thetakeaway.org. So from Paycon lowriders to Pontiacs to V-dubs.
My name is Lynn from Martha's Vineyard, and I loved my Volkswagen Bug. It was the very first car that I bought when I was 17 years old. It was a used Volkswagen, and it was absolutely the love of my life, and it went forever, and I miss it very much.
On today's Takeaway, car memories. Share your nostalgia car story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway. So Iran has the Paycon. Maybe you have a Rambler in your past or a Corvair, Karmann Ghia, AMC Pacer, Chevy Vega, Ford Falcon, Plymouth Fury, Citroen, Isetta. Oh, I could go on and on.
It's the car, right? Chicks love the car.
Car love. Got some?
Hi, this is Terry from out in Eastern Oregon. I used to own, way back in the early 80s, a 911E Porsche. And that thing could gobble up the road like nobody's business. And it was even pretty economical for the time. It was a fun car to drive and wish I could have afforded to keep it.
Thank you, Terry. For one of you in Michigan, Glenn, it's a Z car. Datsun 280ZX, 1981. Why? Because Glenn says he felt like Steve McQueen and James Bond when driving that stick.
Saw the design of the world's most insanely kick-ass spy car.
It's a spy car? What else does it do?
Press that red button?
Wait, is it gonna kill everybody?
Press that blue button?
Hey, this is Rudy Gonzalez calling from Fort Worth, Texas. The car that brings back a lot of memories for me and is nostalgic is my 1964 Chevy Chevelle. That was my first car, and even though it was a four-door sedan, I felt like the coolest kid in town driving around in that little cream puff.
Hey, you're supposed to be the fast thing in the valley, man, but that can't be your car. It must be your mama's car.
And by the late 60s, Chevelles grew up to be muscle cars.
Hi, this is Lynn. I'm calling from Wisconsin. A 1964 red Mustang driven by a boy my parents despised. Perfect.
Just a boy in a Chevy truck. It had a tendency of getting stuck.
Those Stang drivers, the Mustang, the mini muscle car from Provo, Utah. I love the yellow Mustang I had in high school from 1970 to 72. That car brings back memories of friends and Carole King on the 8-track tape player. Such carefree, wonder-filled times. 8-track tapes, Mustangs. I'm in the Wayback Machine, Mr. Peabody.
It used to be so easy living here with you. You were light and
this is Jane Byron from Morris Plains, New Jersey. An orange Karmann Ghia makes me nostalgic for Napa, California. In 1980, my best friend Linda and I drove up from Los Angeles to visit her parents and her hometown. It was the first of many trips to Napa. Linda and I are still friends, although mostly via Facebook since we live on opposite coasts.
Had to be one of those, the Ghia. Germany's date with Italy.
Hi, this is Tim from Mineola, New York. My first car was a 55 Studebaker Commander with an 8-ball on the shifter and a chewed-up front seat that required your girlfriend to sit close. Good times.
Once she lures you behind the wheel, you will be hers, body and soul.
And then there were the station wagon days. Remember the country squire wagons with the fake wood trim? From Milford, New Hampshire, one of you says, my nostalgia car is a big old 1990 Chevy Suburban. My father brought me home from the hospital in it, and we had it until I was 16. Miami, Florida. Chevy Nova. I remember my mom learning how to drive in that big green car and how, as kids, we knew what a really big deal that was. It was freedom for her and for all of us.
Hi, my name is Caitlin. I'm calling from Ferndale, Michigan. My nostalgia car would be my grandpa's car. After my grandpa died, I bought his car from the trust. It was a 94 Buick Park Avenue, tan with tan interior. Inside the center console, there was a notepad, some bolts that he saved from everything, and a cassette tape of Boxcar Willie.
Trailers for sale to rent, rooms to let 50 cents.
I listened to that tape while I drove, and I felt a little closer to my grandpa that day.
My grandpa had one of those. His Buick was a Riviera. And from Bob Heavy in Coventry, Rhode Island, my 97 Corolla that was used to teach two kids how to drive, it's been in three small accidents and has 264,122 miles. Share your odometer number and car memories with us at 877-8MY-TAKE or at thetakeaway.org. King of the road. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. More down-to-the-wire dealings on Capitol Hill, where Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick joins me now. Todd, welcome.
Hi, John.
So I guess the news today is not so much that a Republican and a Democrat are working together, but that a senator and a member of the House are working together on the budget. Explain.
Boy, you know more about this place than they give you credit for. That's exactly right. Both of those things are true. John, we have a deal on the budget that lasts about 2 years. Don't get too terribly excited. Yes, there's some cooperation. Yes, they have a deal. It is a narrow deal. It is small. It is not a grand bargain. It's a mini bargain, but it may just keep us out of trouble for a little while. Let's hear from Republican of Wisconsin, chairman of the Budget Committee, Paul Ryan. You've heard of him. Listen.
I think this agreement is a clear improvement on the status quo. This agreement makes sure that we don't have a government shutdown scenario in January. It makes sure that we don't have another government shutdown scenario in October. It makes sure that we don't lurch from crisis to crisis.
The voice from the House of Representatives there, Paul Ryan. And on the Senate side?
His counterpart, Senator Patty Murray, Democrat of Washington, chairman of the Senate Budget Committee, who helped make the deal. Listen.
So this deal doesn't solve all of our problems, but I think it is an important step in helping to heal some of the wounds here in Congress, to rebuild some trust and show that we can do something without a crisis right around the corner.
All right. So this goes beyond kicking the can down the road, healing wounds between the House and the Senate. Any evidence of that in your probings either yesterday or today?
There is some, but these deals still have to pass. For all of the healing talk from Ryan and Murray, this deal has not passed the House yet, and it hasn't passed the Senate. That's likely to happen, but it is far from certain, and you're about to figure out why here. Here's what it does. Let's just tell you what it does. It spends just a shade over $1 trillion in fiscal 2014 and 2015. And that they split the baby. The House and the Senate were far apart on a budget number. They split it right down the middle, just what compromise is supposed to be. Now, remember sequestration, those
right.
Nasty cuts? What this deal does is sort of give a little bit to both sides. It replaces part of sequestration for this year and next year. Not even all of it, but about $63 billion worth of relief from sequestration, and then it has about $25 or $23 billion in deficit reduction. And that's pretty much all the deal does. There are no tax increases. You pay a little bit more for an airline ticket. You used to pay between $2.50 and $5 for TSA user fees. Now that's going to be $5.60 for every ticket, no matter what. So that goes up a bit. If you're a federal employee, you pay more on your pension. There's a few other things in there. But it doesn't deal with Medicare. It doesn't deal with Social Security. It certainly doesn't deal with taxes or corporate loopholes or anything like that. And what does that tell you? They haven't made any of the hard decisions. And indeed, Paul Ryan and Patty Murray both said when they talked to reporters yesterday, hey, all these months that we've been talking, all that time you guys have been standing outside the room listening to us, we stipulated on day one, no hard decisions. Let's stay out of the mud. Let's do the easy stuff so that we can get something. And
well,
that's what they've done.
It's not a headline that the Democrats don't want to touch entitlements and the Republicans don't want to go anywhere near raising taxes. But maybe the headline here is that the Congress maybe is fallen in love with sequestration on some level. They're tolerating it, even though they're repealing it a little bit here.
Well, you will find some members who've fallen in love with sequestration. You'll be able to tell who they are tomorrow on the House floor, John. House Republicans, conservatives who vote against this bill, and there will be dozens of them, those are the ones who love sequestration. Hey, don't spend $1 trillion. We like the old number that was lower. We don't want to vote for anything that's going to spend more. And by the way, some Republicans are afraid they'll get primaried if they do. Marco Rubio's an example, conservative from Florida. We all know he wants to run for president. His statement opposing this budget agreement on spending grounds came out about 12 seconds after Paul Ryan was finished.
All right. So the politics of this and the finances of this, so far there's no Tea Party constituency standing up and saying this is dead in the water, right? That's good news.
not dead in the water, but they don't like it. Some Tea Party groups, Heritage Action, Freedom Works, have come out against this deal. That would pressure a lot of Republicans to vote against it and pressure them to stand against the last Democratic ask before the end of the year, John. Unemployment insurance has not been renewed. That's the next fight.
We will be watching. Todd Zwillick will be watching and tweeting from Capitol Hill. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much.
You bet, John.
So we've been aware of a behind-the-scenes leadership shakeup inside the North Korean government for about a week now. But this week, the media strategy of young Kim Jong-un got revealed to the world in an unprecedented gesture of openness, public humiliation. What do we call it? North Korean leader Kim Jong-un ousting his uncle and mentor, General Jang Sun-taek, from office for what the ruling party described as criminal acts that baffle imagination, captured on video. Pictures of General Jang Sun-taek being dragged from parliament, circulated to the North Korean public on state TV, and eventually circulated to the world. Thomas Hubbard is former ambassador to South Korea from 2001 to 2004 and chairman of the Korea Society. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Thomas, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
So as a former ambassador, what do you make of this openness or public humiliation that the North Koreans are obviously an audience for, but apparently the global, there's a global audience for it as well?
Well, I think this is very ironic and, as you suggest, very dramatic. North Korea is not one of the world's most transparent places. It's very hard to tell what's going on there. But this episode, I think, is particularly unexpected because it has been so public. Not only was Jang Sun-taek thought to be the second most powerful figure in North Korea, the husband of Kim Jong-un's aunt, but also, that in itself, removing him was a dramatic step, and then doing it all on film for the world to see him being hauled away that way, I think is a very unusual event in North Korea.
There's been a lot of discussion of the significance of the general's ouster and how this will affect relations with China, how it will make China possibly nervous, since he had very strong ties within China and was very well respected within China. But I'm wondering if this videotaping indicates a kind of media strategy that's personal to Kim Jong-un, that going forward, this is the way he likes to roll.
Well, you know, we have seen more of him than any of his the previous leaders, his father and his grandfather. In fact, he has been seen out in public, seen at amusement parks, seen talking to children. He's been speaking, which is publicly, which is something his father didn't do. So I think this is going to be a much more public leader of North Korea than we've seen before. Now, what that means is another question. It does look as if this young man has decided to consolidate his regime at a much earlier stage than any of us expected. We saw Jang Sun-taek as being some sort of a regent along with his wife, the sister of the late leader Kim Jong-il, and he's been moved out of the way much earlier than most of us expected. I think perhaps he overreached, this young new leader seems to feel strong enough to consolidate his rule. And one aspect of this public event was that a number of very senior North Korean leaders were personally humiliated by having to get up and denounce their erstwhile colleague, and many of them shed tears on film.
Now, it's obviously, perilous to get into sort of psychological analysis here. And as a former ambassador to South Korea, I know you probably don't necessarily want to go there. But in thinking about, from the perspective of Kim Jong-un, two generations now of a closed North Korea that is essentially a cult of personality around one individual, he's watched this his entire life. I'm just wondering if he views himself as being on a world stage or if he just views North Korea as kind of his own personal video game, that he can do whatever he wants, and that's got to be alarming to China.
Well, I think probably the answer is closer to your second point, that that he does see North Korea as his personal fiefdom. We haven't heard much from the Chinese on this. Chang-Sung-Tek was thought to have been close to the Chinese, or to be close to the Chinese. You know, Kim Jong-un himself has not yet visited China. He hasn't been there. It's striking that the Chinese, new Chinese leader, Xi Jinping, warmly welcomed the South Korean leader, Park Geun-hye, to China. But he has not yet met with the new North Korean leader, and that says something about the environment in which this is taking place.
Any reaction on the nuclear issue, do you think, from all of this?
You know, it's hard to connect it. I think the most dangerous aspect of North Korea is the nuclear program and its related missile development programs, and you know, it's very hard to draw any ties between this. Many thought that Chang-Sung-Tek was one of those North Korean leaders who was advocating, a focus on economics, on an economic opening. You can never be very sure about where anybody stands in North Korea. But moving him aside suggests that that the leadership is going to still put its emphasis on the military.
So even speculatively, we know of no voice of restraint or constraint on the nuclear issue or any other in North Korea right now, with the result
no,
of...
No, not within North Korea. I don't think so. I think the Chinese are advising the North Koreans not to proceed down that path, but we don't know to what degree the North Koreans are listening.
And what kind of influence could possibly be seen down the line there. Thomas Hubbard, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thomas Hubbard, former ambassador to South Korea from 2001 to 2004. He's also chairman of the Korea Society. Coming up, a global look at the risk of nuclear war. It's not a country-by-country calculation. As we've seen this hour, one can't really speak about the nations of Iran and North Korea without being reminded of their nuclear programs and the international efforts being made to diminish or eliminate the growth of nuclear weapons by those regimes. But the nuclear threat to the world is by no means confined to the so-called rogue states. The presence of nuclear weapons is constant and global. It is quite likely that if you are in the U.S. or Russia or South Asia or China, that either a nuclear warhead is aimed at you or your city shows up on some target list somewhere. As recently as 2010, in an Associated Press poll, 62% of Americans said they believe no country should have nuclear weapons, not even the United States. And yet more than 50 years after John F. Kennedy called for the eradication of nuclear weapons, the U.S. has some 8,000 weapons, 1,000 of which could be ready to launch in a few minutes. Joe Cirincione is president of Plowshares Fund and author of the book Nuclear Nightmares, Securing the World Before It Is Too Late. Welcome, Joe.
Thank you for having me.
So is a country-by-country approach to assessing the nuclear threat useful in your view?
You cannot solve this problem by playing nuclear whack-a-mole, by trying to tamp it down wherever it rears up, in part because the only way to stop countries from getting new weapons is to have a comprehensive approach that includes other countries eliminating the weapons they have. Steady steps towards disarmament build up the international cooperation you need to block new states from getting them. Blocking the new states creates the security that encourages other states to give up the weapons. So you have to keep flipping this coin over and over again.
So while positive, this statement from Secretary of State John Kerry, you would not necessarily consider hopeful. Listen, here he is speaking on Tuesday.
We're at a crossroads. We're at one of those really hinge points in history. One path could lead to an enduring resolution in international community's concerns about Iran's nuclear program. The other path could lead to continued hostility and potentially to conflict.
Now, as significant as Iran is, you would view the hinge point of history as the moment that John Kerry starts talking about U.S. and Russian weapons and the global proliferation of nuclear weapons.
Well, they are two sides of the same coin. I mean, what you hear, especially in Washington, when you talk about cutting the overly redundant nuclear force the United States has, is why should we cut weapons when new states are trying to get them? So Iran, in many ways, is a gateway issue. You have got to resolve the Iran crisis in order to convince politicians that it's safe to cut our own weapons.
Although convincing politicians that we don't need 8,000 nuclear weapons to stand as a defense against a non-existent Iranian weapon seems to me almost the point of lunacy.
There is no logical strategic connection between the 8,000 weapons we have and the possibility that Iran might someday get 1 or 10, but psychologically and politically there is. I personally can't think of any mission that requires one nuclear weapon. There hasn't been for 68 years. Despite all the wars, all the threats, we and no one else has ever used a nuclear weapon. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe you need 5 or 50 or 500 just to be sure. We have 8,000.
Mm. Two big points that come out of this book I want to talk about. First, you spend a lot of time talking about the threats in South Asia, that there's not enough concern about what goes on between India and Pakistan.
Yeah. You know, many people look at Iran as the nuclear threat. And in fact, 70% of all the stories written about nuclear policy are written about Iran. But if you look at the most dangerous country on earth, as I say in the book, Nuclear Nightmares, it's really Pakistan. They have 100 nuclear weapons, an unstable government, a collapsing economy, strong Islamic fundamentalist influences in the military and intelligence apparatus. Oh, and Al-Qaeda operating inside their national territory and an ongoing border dispute with another nuclear-armed country, India. That is a recipe for disaster.
What's the countermeasure? What's the approach there? What would you do?
Well, this gets exactly to your point of the comprehensive approach. In order to get it in a position where we can do something about the Pakistan nuclear threat, you've got to create an international climate where countries are giving up nuclear weapons, not building them.
Everybody doing it at once.
Everybody walking down that same path together. That's the only way you're going to convince countries that they shouldn't have the toys the big boys do.
Now, the most chilling issue that comes up in this book, and I was actually surprised by it because while it's obvious, in a certain way, it's actually not thought about very much. And that is the idea that time is passing here. The nuclear age began in the 1940s, and we are fast getting to a point where people for whom that is a living memory are passing from the scene. And very shortly after that, we will be at a point where people for whom the Cold War is no longer a living memory. And we'll be left with a generation that doesn't really understand maybe the significance of these weapons, even though they're still around.
It is. It is chilling. It's like one of those science fiction novels where the generation discovers the bomb that previous generations have built and they've forgotten all about it, but it's still alive. That's the situation we're in now. People think nuclear weapons are something out of the past, or whatever issues there are being resolved by government policies. They couldn't be more wrong. These are nightmares that could explode literally at any time and fundamentally change our way of life, our very existence.
20 years from now, 30 years from now, 50 years from now.
At any time, as long as you leave these most destructive weapons we've ever built in fallible human hands, they are going to be used. We have to get them down to the lowest level possible so we can envision the day where we might be able to eliminate them entirely.
Who's working on this generational piece of getting this done while there's still a collective memory of the significance of nuclear weapons, at least what they can actually do?
Well, some of the people that gave the impetus to a world free of nuclear weapons, George Shultz, Henry Kissinger, Sam Nunn, Bill Perry, two Republicans, two Democrats, are very keenly aware of their own mortality, of the need to pass the torch on. So you do see organizations, foundations, My Own Plowshares Fund, Sam Nunn's Nuclear Threat Initiative, other foundations, and dozens of organizations around the world working on this to make sure that people don't forget the dangers that we created.
Joe Cernciani is president of the Plowshares Fund. He's author of the book Nuclear Nightmares, Securing the World Before It Is Too Late. Joe, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me on.
The car culture in America significantly predates the nuclear age. We've been hearing from you nostalgia car stories. I guess for the Beatles, they'd be driving an MGA here. What about you?
Katie Hudak, calling from Hilton Head, South Carolina. My nostalgia car is my mother's bright yellow Dodge Dart Swinger with a black top and black vinyl interior, which when we got back into after being at the swimming pool all day was about 500 degrees inside, and we'd have to take our wet towels and drape them over all the seats, and my mother had to drape one over the black steering wheel in order to get home.
One of my first girlfriends had a yellow Dodge Dart Swinger. Oh, my God. One of you from Fenton, Missouri, tells a first car story about a 1977 Alfa Romeo Spider, a high school graduation present. I remember driving with the top down, listening to the radio, felt free and very adult. Nothing could stop me from anything. And then I totaled it. I'll never forget making my first call on a cellular phone to break the news to my father. I was crying so hard. I'm sure he thought I killed someone. He was so relieved I wasn't dead. It took me a few years to realize that my fear of disappointing him was so trivial compared to his fear that I was hurt. So I will always think of my father, my first car, and his pure fatherly heart. There's a nice story. Can you outdo that one? Share your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. Drive my car. This is The Takeaway.
Baby, you can drive my car. Yes, I'm gonna be a star. Baby, you can drive my car. And baby, I love you. Beep, 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 yeah. Beep, 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 yeah.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.